Hello and welcome to Switch Your Money On. I'm Susanna Streeter, the head of money and markets here at Hargreaves Lansdown. And as usual, I'm with Sarah Coles, head of personal finance. So Sarah, my feet have just touched the ground after a busy couple of weeks covering the recent market volatility combined with the party conference season here in the UK. I took what seemed to be like an interminable train journey via Newport, Abergavenny, Hereford, Chester to get to the Labour Party conference in Liverpool on a very packed carriage on what must have been the hottest day in October for years.
Yeah, well, the weather was really all over the place in October. But you were taking the temperature of the mood in the room at the conference too.
Yes, I certainly was. I was there listening to the speech by the Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves. There was a real bum fight to get into the hall. It was really interesting to hear about her plans for a national wealth fund to kickstart growth and invest in a whole range of green energy initiatives, from battery plants to clean steel plants. It would have a target to leverage £3 of private sector funding from every £1 it invests. And I think it was a bit of a coup that she won the endorsement of the former governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney. And he said in a video message played out in the hall that it was time to put her ideas into action. And one of those ideas is liberalising planning laws to make it easier to speed up infrastructure developments. But there is still plenty of scepticism around about how much this will really move the dial. And there wasn't really that much detail about spending plans other than that Labour would borrow more to invest, but only if it meets fiscal rules. Labour also clearly nervous about the potential of upsetting the bond markets with plans of unfunded splurges.
So that's not really a surprise given the recent turmoil, and that saw bond prices fall sharply and yields shoot up. So that was spot by data in the US, which indicated the labour market is still super strong there, and that's led to any hopes of interest rate cuts being pushed way back on the horizon. So yields did inch down again, but concerns are still lingering.
It's been quite a ride for oil prices as well over the past month, with a barrel of Brent crude appearing to head towards $100 a barrel before performing a U-turn and falling back and then heading sharply upwards again following the troubles with the Israel-Hamas conflict. Of course, our thoughts are with anyone caught up with this terrible tragedy, which is, of course, anyone's primary concern. But it has also impacted oil prices.
Yeah, so oil prices are super sensitive. So they're being pushed down by investor concerns about growth in the global economy and then pushed upwards by tightness of supply and then worries about possible further repercussions in the Middle East. So they're incredibly reactive to each piece of news.
Given the dance around in oil prices and the focus on the green transition amid strange weather and worries about climate change, in this podcast we're focusing on energy and commodities in an episode we're calling Oil Be Damned.
So we're going to speak to Sophie Lund-Yates, our lead equity analyst, about companies to watch as oil fluctuates and countries accelerate investment in the green transition.
And we'll have a chat to Nick van Dyke, CEO of Oort Energy, a company investing in one energy alternative, green hydrogen. So Nick, has the time come for hydrogen, do you think?
Well, hydrogen's already a ubiquitous molecule, so it's used a lot already, but the time has come for green hydrogen. We need to make that change from using fossil fuel-based hydrogen to green hydrogen.
That's great. Well, we look forward to delving loads more into this later in the podcast. We'll also hear from Emma Hall, our Head of Investment Analysis and Research, who's been speaking to a fund manager focused on commodities.
So let's focus on the oil price right now. It's been a bit all over the shop recently. Near the end of September, the psychologically important level of $100 a barrel appeared to be in sight for Brent crude. The International Energy Agency expects demand to keep growing this year. It's been boosted by buoyant airline sales and strong summer travel, the increased use of oil for power generation, and a surge in activity in the petrochemicals industry, particularly in China. But demand is expected to weaken next year as the post-pandemic rebound fizzles out, weaker economic conditions drift in, and new electric vehicles become more popular.
Yes, and worries about interest rates staying higher for longer have also led to concerns about the US economy heading for a more difficult landing, which of course then weighs down on prices. The worry is that if employers are still finding it hard to recruit, then wage growth will stay strong and inflationary pressures won't ease. It means interest rates could stay higher for longer, which could make life a lot tougher for companies and consumers. And of course, this would then mean less demand for oil, which the IEA already expected next year.
However, the Israel-Hamas conflict led to another spike in the price of oil. The Israeli government has warned that it could be a long and difficult time ahead, which has led to concerns over repercussions across the Middle East. It would be desperate for people in the region and would also impact the supply of oil. Already at October's OPEC meeting, Saudi Arabia and Russia signalled they would continue with their production cuts, moves which are also keeping upwards pressure on prices.
So as oil heads higher again, it's fueling worries about inflation because, of course, oil prices feed into the supply chain across the board. So that's everything from the cost of farming to production prices, transport and even the energy use of retailers at the end of the process. So we have seen inflation ease off, but there's a risk that oil prices could reignite higher inflation, putting even more pressure on people's pockets.
So the economy remains incredibly vulnerable to oil prices, and part of the solution for that is a transition to new greener forms of energy. Now, it's why there's been so much focus on the transition to net zero by 2050, when we're aiming to be no longer adding to greenhouse emissions. In September, an awful lot of the UK's net zero pledges were pushed back, including a five-year delay in the sale of new petrol and diesel cars to 2035. While the ban on new gas boilers by 2035 remains in place, the government introduced exemptions for lower income households and the target that all rental properties should have an energy performance certificate of C or higher from 2025 has been ditched, although the government says that net zero targets will still be hit by 2050.
So there's a lot of change for energy and oil companies to adapt to. So it feels like a good time to bring in Sophie now. But first things first, we should probably start with the fact that oil giant BP has been in the headline a fair bit recently. So Sophie, what's going on?
Yes, BP hit the headlines after it emerged that CEO Bernard Looney would be stepping down with immediate effect after he admitted to misleading the board over disclosures relating to personal relationships with colleagues. So the group's chief financial officer is going to be taking the helm on an interim basis while the search for a permanent replacement is underway.
So what does all this mean for investors? It's a lot more uncertainty, isn't it?
An unexpected change of leadership is never ideal. It essentially increases uncertainty and leaves questions unanswered, especially around strategy and things like that. Looney has made big strides in driving the group's green energy plans forward. Until a successor emerges, it'll be difficult to call what direction BP will take at this pivotal time. And any prolonged uncertainty is likely to weigh on investor sentiment. But overall, the market's reaction to this change has been fairly muted. It seems that investors are more concerned about important broader issues, including the oil price and long-term green strategies.
Thanks, Sophie. So speaking of the oil price, the FTSE 100 holds another oil major that's been watching developments there closely, doesn't it?
It does indeed. We're, of course, referring to Shell. It's a leading supplier of liquefied natural gas, or LNG. We think the outlook for this part of Shell's business remains positive, and Shell's planning to grow sales volumes in this category between 20 and 30% by 2030. Another thing to keep in mind where Shell is concerned is that strong financials enable it to self-fund significant organic investment. But with a big chunk of cash flows ring-fenced for shareholder returns, there are some concerns as to how long this can continue. We've already seen this year's CapEx guidance trimmed in the face of challenging trading conditions. To reduce its reliance on oil and gas-based revenues, investment levels will need to remain high for the foreseeable future.
So Sophie, who else have you been looking at in this space?
I've had a look at ExxonMobil, which is another very recognisable oil and gas major. In fact, it's the largest independent oil and gas group in the world. It's in the news at the moment because it's in advanced talks to buy one of America's leading fracking companies called Pioneer Natural Resources, with the deal worth around $60 billion. So just absolutely huge sums. Exxon made profit of just under $56 billion last year, so it has some firepower to throw at big acquisitions like this.
That's not the only reason it's been in the news, though, is it?
Unfortunately not. Central to this deal is the group's shale oil and gas business, and the boss of this unit has been arrested because of sexual assault allegations. This news has more than wiped out recent gains on the group's valuation. This raises some governance questions, with governance, of course, being the G in ESG. And this is far from the only ESG consideration that investors need to be mindful of. Future-proofing oil and gas businesses depends on the successful execution of renewable strategies. Looking at the UK market, Shell's efforts here have a lot to be desired. And looking further ahead, we have to consider that oil as part of the energy mix is going to be declining, which is where we need to chat to our ESG analyst, Laura Hoy. Laura, what's going to replace oil and gas?
Thanks, Sophie. You are absolutely right. Countries around the world have committed to meeting net zero by 2050, and that will mean demand for oil will fall substantially over the next 20 years. Renewables and efficiency improvements are expected to pick up a lot of that slack, but there are other areas that are sometimes overlooked with huge amounts of growth potential. Now, one of those areas is hydrogen, which we're going to hear about later, but another energy source worth talking about is nuclear. Now, there is a lot of controversy when it comes to nuclear, and not for no reason. While accidents are rare, those that do happen can be catastrophic. And it's also costly and time-consuming to get new plants online. But with that said, global investment in nuclear power is going to roughly double to hit net zero in 2050. And there are a lot of advantages to nuclear, particularly when it comes to lowering emissions. Once plants are online, they're cheap to run and they come with very low emissions. It's also a relatively reliable source of energy. You know, whereas solar and wind depend on the elements, nuclear could offer a baseline of uninterrupted energy. So the bottom line is that nuclear is likely to be at least a small part of the future energy mix in a net zero scenario.
So looking at nuclear energy as a growing industry, it makes sense for me to briefly touch on Rolls-Royce. While the vast majority of Rolls-Royce's business rests on its manufacture and servicing of long-haul aircraft engines, it is making increased inroads into nuclear. So Rolls-Royce's vast infrastructure and technology means it's in a reasonable position to develop technology for a new generation of small nuclear power plants in the UK. It's also recently cleared the first hurdle and been selected by the UK government as one of a small handful of companies being picked to develop small modular nuclear reactors. As I said, we're in very early days, but this is certainly an exciting area to watch and one that investors shouldn't ignore.
Thanks, Sophie and Laura. There's clearly not just an implication for oil companies from the energy transition, but for all sorts of businesses.
Of course, as oil prices rise, we're often reminded that demand for the black stuff won't have a floor under it forever. The global commitment to reach net zero by 2050 suggests we're all going to undergo a major energy transition over the next few decades, and oil will become a much smaller part of the overall mix. Now, when I think about net zero, renewables like wind and solar are the first things to spring to mind.
Yes, me too. And that's for good reason. So the International Energy Agency predicts that some 70% of our energy will come from wind and solar if we reach net zero in 2050.
But that last 30% is worth exploring. It's a place where some of the most exciting investment opportunities are blossoming. One of these is hydrogen. It's only a tiny percentage of the future overall energy mix, but in terms of growth, the opportunity is enormous. The IEA predicts that global hydrogen use will increase by almost five times between 2020 and 2050. But not all hydrogen power is created equally. Depending on how it's made, it can have a varying impact. If net zero is the aim, then green hydrogen is an important part of the puzzle. So this is a really good time to bring in Nick van Dyke, CEO of Oort Energy, a company that's making green hydrogen a possibility. Welcome, Nick. So first of all, can you explain what green hydrogen is? How is it currently made?
Hydrogen gas itself is not coloured. We often refer to hydrogen as green hydrogen, blue hydrogen, grey hydrogen, brown hydrogen, and even turquoise, yellow or pink hydrogen. When we talk about green hydrogen specifically, we really mean hydrogen produced from water using green electricity, such as solar or wind power. This process is known as electrolysis. Electrolysis is an electrochemical reaction to split water into its components of hydrogen and oxygen. Electrochemical reaction is just the use of electricity to perform a chemical reaction. Electrolysis, therefore, uses electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen, and importantly, emits no carbon dioxide in the process. This is opposed to, say, grey hydrogen, which is produced from the fossil fuel natural gas and ultimately produces a lot of carbon dioxide as a byproduct, contributes to climate change. What we do at Oort Energy is we manufacture the equipment that makes green hydrogen.
So green hydrogen sounds like it's a sort of an emerging product. So are there any industries where it's already established, or is it sort of part of a mix in lots of industries?
So hydrogen itself is already used ubiquitously. So green hydrogen is an emerging product. But the two main uses of hydrogen today are the production of fertilizer and the production of chemicals. These are behind closed doors, so we don't often see them. The manufacture of fertilizer begins with a chemical reaction known as the Haber-Bosch reaction. The majority of that fertilizer is made from using hydrogen made from fossil fuels. This produces the global warming gas, carbon dioxide, of course. So we're gradually moving from grey hydrogen to green hydrogen. And moving fertilizer production to green hydrogen would make a significant impact on global carbon dioxide emissions. But importantly, it requires no change in lifestyle. So we could use the same amount of fertilizer, eat the same food.
So you've talked there about the fertilizer industry. Which other industries are you expecting particularly high growth?
The most obvious example of this for the future is in the transport sector. Hydrogen can be converted back into energy to power, say, a bus or a truck. The bus or truck can fill up in minutes. So essentially, that bus is running on wind or sun, just not directly. Hydrogen may be a better option for some applications in the future, particularly for commercial applications where the advantages of long ranges and fast fueling is important. Hydrogen itself is a natural reductant. Okay, this means it can be used in industries such as steel manufacture. Actually, steel manufacture currently uses carbon or coke as a reductant, and that's what's used to make steel, but of course it releases vast quantities of carbon dioxide. Green hydrogen can really be used to clean up that steel manufacture and eliminate those emissions. The challenge, of course, is coke is very cheap and the production of green hydrogen is somewhat more expensive. But just as energy and wind power is reduced in price, green hydrogen will come down in price as it becomes more common.
So are there any sectors where hydrogen isn't an option?
Hydrogen is an important part of the solution to help solve the climate change problem. But it's only part of the solution. It's still very early days. But let me give you an example where, at least in my opinion, hydrogen is not necessarily the answer. There's a lot of work looking at burning hydrogen to produce heat. Heating as a sector is very difficult to decarbonise, particularly as gas is used to heat homes and commercial buildings. Now that gas can be changed for hydrogen gas using the same pipework and burnt in the same way, albeit slightly different burner is needed, but essentially it's the same process. On the face of it, this looks like a great solution. Instead of burning natural gas with the associated carbon dioxide emissions, we burn hydrogen with no emissions. However, if we go back to looking at that provenance of hydrogen, it only makes sense if we use green hydrogen. And green hydrogen comes ultimately from renewable electricity. Actually, my opinion is I think there are better ways to heat your home using electricity directly than converting to hydrogen and burning that hydrogen.
Fascinating to talk to you, Nick. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It's going to be really interesting to see how the energy mix develops over the coming years. So let's bring in Emma Wall now, our Head of Investment Analysis and Research, who's been speaking to George Cheveley, manager of the 91 Global Gold Fund.
Hello, George.
Hello, Emma.
So we're talking today about commodity prices, not least oil, which has been creeping back up again, in part because of tensions and indeed conflict in the Middle East, and in part because of a number of different macroeconomic factors. And if we play this through, rising oil prices over the last 18 months have flown through into inflation across the globe, rising prices, because oil, of course, is an input cost. But then equally, when there is uncertainty and volatility, it also has an impact on gold, which is what we're going to sort of narrow in on, as a perceived safe haven. And we saw this at the beginning of the calendar year, and we're beginning to see this again at the moment, aren't we?
Yes, that's correct. And it's very easy to say gold is a safe haven in times of uncertainty, but it's also can be very volatile as a result of that. And I think we need to look at, there are several factors actually impacting on gold prices at the moment, and safe haven is one of them, but not the only one.
And the perception of gold as a safe haven, I think perception, as you've alluded to yourself there, is a really important word, is because it is universally understood and valued as a commodity, and because it's not so linked to other parts of the sort of global asset mix. But as you've said yourself, it is volatile in its own right, and it is driven by factors which aren't always forecastable or indeed controllable.
Yeah, and one of its actually simplest, the main functions of gold is its liquidity. So gold itself is one of the most liquid asset classes you can get involved in. And the value of gold traded in any particular day can be almost as much as the whole S&P 500. And that means, you know, when people are looking for places to put their money, it's very easy to get in. It's also very easy to sell when in the midst of a crisis. And we do sometimes see in the absolute sort of middle of a crisis, you will see gold go down initially, though it tends to recover very, very quickly. And that's really just people wanting to access liquidity.
And so what are the factors that are driving the gold price at the moment then?
Well, clearly we have a conflict in the Middle East, and that clearly was one of the factors last week. But it came at a time when, in fact, a lot of technical funds were very short gold. We'd seen gold prices fall in the preceding week or so quite sharply. And that was really around the market's perception that the Fed back in September had really changed its tune and was looking for rates to stay higher for longer. And after the Open Markets Committee meeting, we saw those minutes which suggested that. What happened, of course, was the bond markets reacted, sold off, and we saw yields rise in the bond markets quite rapidly. And then last week, the Fed started to signal that, in fact, the bond markets were doing their job for them and had finally taken heed of the Fed's advice that rates needed to be higher for longer. And that actually ironically meant the Fed doesn't, or certainly hinted that it would not need to keep raising rates. So then we had the reverse effect. In the end, do we know what's going to happen? Not really. But what this type of action, this volatility where you see the market move one way and then very quickly the other, does hint that we're sort of at some sort of inflection point. And I think, you know, as the market's been trying to see all year, is when is the Fed going to pause? When's it going to possibly cut rates? And I think the action of the last month shows that we're getting very close to that point.
And then obviously, history is no guarantee of the future, and none of us have a crystal ball. But looking at other periods where we have been in a similar point in the cycle, what next for gold then, if it is pause from here, if it is even pivot from here on rate policy?
It's history isn't too much help in this case, because there are very few sort of historical precedents for this. But one would simply say, if we are going to see a pause in rate rises, which seems to be coming, and then if we do see a slowdown and rates come off, that is generally a positive environment for gold. And we would expect to see that, particularly if the dollar starts to weaken. And we've seen, again, we've had a very strong dollar for 3 months, but again, it's paused in the last few weeks. That could also be very supportive for gold.
George, thank you very much.
Thank you, Emma. Thanks very much. Goodbye.
That was Emma Wall there talking to George Cheapley, manager of the 91 Global Gold Fund. And please remember, those are the views of the fund manager and are not individual stock recommendations. You're listening to Switch Your Money On from Hargreaves Lansdown. And now, to end this episode, we have a quick statistic looking at just how higher oil prices have affected petrol prices. So, the highest ever petrol price was in July last year, when petrol hit £1.915 a litre. But, Sarah, can you guess how much of that was made up by tax?
Well, I know the levels are really shocking, because I know there's fuel duty and there's VAT as well. So I think it's getting on for about half of it, isn't it?
Yes, almost. You're absolutely right. It's actually between 43% and 44%. So I'm going to give you that, Sarah.
It is a lot. I'm almost tempted to start riding my son's moped instead of driving, although I'm not sure I fancy my chances on the country lanes around here.
Yes, I think the bus might be a slightly safer option. Well, that's all from us for now. But before we go, we do need to remind you that this was recorded on October the 16th, 2023, and all information was correct at the time of recording.
Nothing in this podcast is personal advice. You should seek advice if you're not sure what's right for you. Unlike the security offered by cash, investments rise and fall in value, so you could get back less than you invest.
Yes, this is not advice or a recommendation to buy, sell or hold any investment. No view is given on the present or future value or price of any investment, and investors should form their own view on any proposed investment.
and this hasn't been prepared in accordance with legal requirements designed to promote the independence of investment research and is considered a marketing communication.
Non-independent research is not subject to FCA rules prohibiting dealing ahead of research. However, HL has put controls in place, including dealing restrictions, physical and information barriers, to manage potential conflicts of interest presented by such dealing.
You can see our full non-independent research disclosure on our website for more information. So all that's left is for me to thank our guests, Nick, George, Sophie, Laura, Emma, and our producer, Elizabeth Hodson.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back again soon. Goodbye.